So I was just sitting here and realising that I don't know whether I did this. I might well have done. Put the clock on White Tara's head. So there's this lovely image of White Tara, and then there's this digital clock sitting on her head. And I might have something to say about that in a bit. So I have a feeling I've got a rant. I've switched on. I'm recording my rant. We'll see. Maybe it's not. So we're on we're on Meta with Dharma's reference still. So a while ago I was having a rant in the community, and a friend said to me, they said, "Oh, Maitri Devi, you only ever say one thing." And so a while later I was thinking, what is this one thing I keep saying? So I tried writing something. I'll just read you a bit of what I wrote. Any living thing grasped too tightly will die. This includes Buddhism, which necessarily must be a living thing. And all helpful form can become oppressive. To talk of the heart is to talk of relationship, not of things. The heart of relationship is the quality between. The singular relationship is necessarily a stuck one, the singular idea too. Perhaps Sangha is a field of beings who may not give up on you, may not be stuck with you and stick you in a singular way. So I have a cry against singularity. And the late 18th, early 19th century poet and mystic Blake also railed against singular vision and what he called Newton's sleep, which was the mechanical clockwork universe. The Sufi mystic, the 20th century Sufi mystic Henri Corbin railed against the Aristotelian logical universal, the abstract bodiless ideas, which he declared were nothing more than the dead body of an angel. So every being or phenomena is particular and unique. But that they are singular, with just one way to perceive them, freezes things into death and eternity. So that's a quote from Jan Kaplinsky I gave a few days ago. But we live in a literal culture where there is a single cause, someone to blame, one goal, one truth, and only one way to see reality. And the consequence, as the writer and I guess mystic philosopher Tom Cheatham says, the consequence is a world illuminated day and night by the detonations of literalist fundamentalisms. A world illuminated day and night by the detonations of literalist fundamentalisms. So we've made this move from beings to phenomena, and we make that move because it can allow us to release our clinging to a literal singularity of being that we have imprisoned ourselves in. But if we're not careful, we can literalize phenomena into things, or ontologically, by declaring them more real and nearer to the truth, when they are no more or less real than beings. So part of this is a problem of language, the perennial problem of language, where even as we talk of flow and process, those very words become fixed into things. From the Perfection of Wisdom text, we find things like forms are like dreams, illusions, the reflections of the moon in water. So we have metaphor to evoke something, to evoke experiences that we don't understand or that are inherently mysterious or are multifaceted in their nature. So maybe this helps stop us stepping out of one prison and then our words accidentally creating another. So the other, another aspect of how we might from moving from beings to phenomena create another trap is that is to do with our worldview, our cosmology maybe, which possibly for many, most, maybe even all of us can be strongly informed by a sort of dominant scientific, materialist, reductive worldview. So we're very familiar with breaking things down to find the truth, to find the ultimate. And we don't notice, firstly, what we lose in that reductive move. We lose life, we lose beings, we lose forces with agency. We gain a sort of atomization. And then the other thing maybe that we do that we don't notice is that despite ourselves being phenomena, we give some portion of ourselves a special status as observer and knower, somehow still standing above and beyond or separate to the phenomenal world. So we continue with our egocentric relation to phenomena. Sort of in the same way we continue with our anthropocentric, our human orientated relation to the world. So we remain unchallenged, but with an added layer of mastery and wisdom, in that now we can see the world as phenomena. So cool. So in Living with Awareness, Sangharakshita talks about how we are not receivers of messages from a fixed universe, but rather that Buddhist philosophy sees everything, and he's talking about the elements here, but the elements are everything. he's talking about all four elements, and then we've got the space element, which includes all of those, and then we have consciousness, which is alive. So he's saying everything is alive. Buddhist philosophy sees everything as alive. The whole universe as alive. We are composed of these alive elements, and it is our own living consciousness that contemplates them. So it requires of us, this way of seeing requires of us to bring a responsive awareness to what we perceive. Because we are active participants in consciousness, not merely receivers of messages from this fixed external universe. And he goes on to say that this way of looking or understanding or experiencing the world calls into question the whole distinction between living me and non-living not me. Nature is perceived as a living presence. The universe is alive, magically so. And the experience is inherently mysterious and inaccessible to definitive knowledge. And finally, he says, I would go so far as to say that a universe conceived of as dead cannot be a universe in which one stands any chance of attaining enlightenment.
Could you repeat that again? Sorry,
yeah.
You just caught your voice.
I would go so far as to say that a universe conceived of as dead cannot be a universe in which one stands any chance of attaining enlightenment. So it leaves us with a question of how we reanimate the world. Or perhaps how we allow that the world is animate. Or, as Sangharakshita says, how we move from gazing out at a world of non-living matter, which occasionally and haphazardly comes to life, and in which even our own life is ultimately reducible to inanimate matter. How do we move from that to this alive, magical universe? Of course, you might want an answer. That might be a problem. So, I do think the space between that opens up between beings, seeing the world as beings and seeing the world as phenomena, can be a very creative one. So, this territory that we're exploring If we don't start fixing ourselves into one or the other and making judgments about which one's better or more real, we can start to notice what each offers to us. They offer different things, different ways of seeing. And between them, I think that can be generative of a sense of aliveness. We can consider the ways that we see, or that we... that we, our assumptions about the phenomena we experience. I mean, what I'm experiencing right now, is that just down to my aliveness and my sensitivity? Or is that because the world is choosing to reveal itself to me in some way? Do I bless the world by witnessing it? Or does it bless me by appearing? Or is it even witnessing me in turn? So we just got some unspoken, unconscious assumptions that we don't even notice about how we think about things. So I just want to start... Well, there was that poem Diyoti gave earlier in the week, something about a mole digging up the earth. I just want to start us even thinking about what that earth might be and start to loosen it and just move it a little bit. And Diyoti's already talked a little bit about beauty, and that it doesn't... it's not inherent to anything. It's something that arises as this sort of betweenness that can happen between us and what we're experiencing, what we're witnessing, that can lead to beauty. I mean, there've been long, long discussions and conversations around what the nature of beauty, whether it's in what is being perceived, whether it's in the eye of the beholder, the perceiver. And I like the way the Greeks used to think about it, which was what happens when something is illuminated by Aphrodite, the goddess of love. Yeah. So we don't know why the world appears to us the way it does, but is that some sort of illumination? Is it illuminating ourselves, itself, for us? But I think mainly this reanimation of the world, it is an act of imagination. It's an act of imagination. It's a willingness to explore just a range, a vast range of ways in which we can come into relationship and understand what this is, what this world is. And it's something that we can play with. None of it sort of none of this play. It's play because we're not thinking in terms of what's the right thing or what's the true thing, but rather back to this question of what helps open, what helps liberate the heart, what helps bring more love into being. So Banti again on the same subject about this animated world. It all runs counter to the way we in the West have been conditioned to experience the body and the world of which it is a part. but it must surely be better, or at the very least more fun, to be an animist and feel that the whole world is animated by spirit. All the same, it is not easy for us to develop a genuine feeling that the material elements are really living entities. And conversely, it is all too easy to generate a false and sentimental notion that the hills are alive by projecting all kinds of imaginary properties onto the world. The hills are alive. We cannot generate a belief in, say, naiads and dryads, these nature spirits, by force of will. Nor can we deny what we know scientifically about the way the universe operates. We have somehow to hunt for a real feeling for the life of things, even from our sophisticated viewpoint. It starts with intuitive knowledge, not a set of beliefs. So it's not projecting our fantasies, it's cultivating the imaginative and the intuitive, sensing into this world. So one way, how I think about it is in terms of blessing. So, blessing. So, phenomena, beings, life, whatever. Understanding that as blessing. And blessing doesn't necessarily... well, we can imagine what that might be like. You might have moments of feeling blessed and it's slightly golden. But I just wonder whether... blessing, to feel blessed, might actually be how it feels now for you, whatever that is. Maybe this is what blessing feels like. Might not always be easy. But we're in a situation which is calling out the loveliness in us, and surely that is blessing, whatever that feels like.